Mini episode 726 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode number 726. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris. Welcoming back to the show a very distinguished guest who we had on the show some time ago, April 1st, 2009, to be exact. That was actually episode 52. Yes, 100 episodes before we moved to our present format of mini episodes. So a little while ago. But again, at that time, we were talking about many of the same subjects we're going to be talking about today, broadly speaking, and that is some of the long-form journalism that he has been pursuing in the ESPN family. We have with us today a very decorated television reporter, sports writer, and author, an eight-time Emmy winner, and somebody who is continuing to do very, very strong work on a number of platforms at ESPN, whether it be E60, whether it be SportsCenter, Outside the Lines, ESPN Radio. It is a pleasure to get to speak to this gentleman and to be able to catch up on some of the great stories that he has been covering. An outstanding second-generation sports journalist as well. His father, one of the all-time greats. But we welcome back to the show. We're very pleased and honored to catch up for the second time with the one and only Jeremy Schapp from ESPN. Jeremy, welcome back to the program. Sir, how are you today?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me. How you been?
Oh, fine, thanks. True pleasure to get to catch up with you. You have had a lot going on recently here, certainly. This latest thing here with the Invictus Games very recently, getting to moderate a panel that includes President Bush and Prince Harry. You know, as you're sitting there a long time ago thinking of some of the panels that you might moderate, things that you might do, I got to believe, you know, that's a pretty random pairing among some of the other dignitaries that were there. But what a huge deal that must have been. How did you keep your nerves under control for that one?
You know, it was interesting. I have to say it wasn't something that I ever expected being a part of. But, you know, everybody felt fortunate to be part of the Invictus Games who was down there for us. You know, it's Prince Harry's brainchild, and President Bush, George W. Bush, the 43rd president, is also very involved in issues involving veterans, particularly the invisible wounds of war. So it made sense for the Bush Institute to sponsor this symposium, to create this symposium addressing those issues. And, it was an honor to have Prince Harry there, who really is committed to this cause and dedicates so much time and so much energy to the Invictus Games, which, you know, have benefited from it, their association with him to an incredible degree. But, yeah, you know, sometimes you're worried about, like, what is the protocol? You know, should I call him Harry, Prince Harry? You know, I guess his name in the military is Henry Wales, because he's technically Prince Henry of Wales. And I have to admit, I'm kind of an Anglophile and an English history buff, but I decided I wouldn't want to scare him by reciting all the kings and queens in order going back to 1066. But he was great. He was very personable, and you could really see his passion for this. And in larger picture, the Invictus Games are just a tremendous event. 500 athletes, 14 countries, everybody has a story. And to be able to give back by showcasing these competitors, these wounded warriors, was really something, you know, meaningful.
Absolutely. And you have to believe, of course, that Harry's own experience in the military, as you said, some of the missions that he's flown probably opened up his eyes to some of the pain and suffering that was out there among the wounded warriors, and such a great worthy cause. And you started to go there. I wanted to draw you out a little bit more on that, but that had to be one of the most deeply inspirational things you've gotten to do, at least in some time, being around everybody there for those couple of days and seeing that kind of pride and spirit and determination from all of the athletes.
No doubt about it. You know, he served two tours in Afghanistan himself, Prince Harry, so he understands the issues. He was a helicopter pilot. And there were so many great stories and so many inspiring moments, and to be part of it and to feel the energy there and the love of country, the love of duty, the love that these men and women have for their fellow veterans and service members, it really was an honor to be part of this.
I can very well imagine that. That had to be very, very cool. It was very interesting following all the coverage on TV, and just really seemed to be a very, very inspirational event. I hate to go from a real high point to a low point here, but it seems the logical segue here in terms of some of the stories you've covered, because not everything is sunshine and light. You've been on top of this Qatar 2022 story for quite some time now, and some of the various disgraces involved in that successful World Cup bid. I'd like to get some thoughts from you on that, and not to ask a political question, but the way that my mind kind of frames this is that when you look in the Arab world and you look at the more recent times, the big divide with the Sunnis and the Shiites, the one that seems to predate that, I think, is rich and poor. And this is a thing where you have to believe if the Arab world itself was united in opposition to what was going on there, that it might be a little bit different. But unfortunately, it seems like it's been this long time pattern of, there's somebody from a poor country, there's refugees from a poor area, and not really seeing the common humanity in the people that are there. So talk about what your perspective has been with that, and really how, at a local level and worldwide, this disgrace of all the people who are, and I would assume continue to die in the service of making this event happen, how that's continued to materialize.
Yeah, I mean, look, there is no doubt that there are terrible human rights abuses taking place when you're talking about the Gulf countries, these very rich countries in the Gulf that have enjoyed so much wealth and so much growth, in particular over the last generation, you know, whether you're talking about the United Arab Emirates, or Abu Dhabi and Dubai, or you're talking about Qatar. And I've been in Bahrain, too, where there's been terrible stuff going on. But, there has to be, and this was made clear in a recent report by Professor John Ruggie of Harvard, who was hired by FIFA to create a code of ethics, basically, in terms of human rights and their vendors and their contractors and subcontractors. There has to be a standard, and it can't just be some bare minimum. You know, this has to be done better, and you can't have people dying, people from very poor countries dying to build the infrastructure for a World Cup or for any other event. And, I hope that FIFA is not just paying lip service to this, that they're actually going to incorporate Ruggie's suggestions into any new codes that they create of conduct and partnerships with construction firms and with organizing committees and so forth. But for a long time, you know, they have been oblivious to this, and I think they feel they're being singled out, or that was the feeling certainly when Sepp Blatter was in charge. At the time that they awarded the 2022 tournament to Qatar, you know, no one had even asked the question, who's going to build this? Is it going to be these workers from South Asia, from India and Nepal and Pakistan and Bangladesh? It wasn't even a subject for discussion. Certainly, that's changing, and much of that is due to the very good work that's been done by people, organizations, NGOs like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International who focused on these issues. But, it's too soon to say that there will be change, but certainly it's encouraging to know that pressure is being applied and the world is paying attention.
They certainly are, and what's very, very interesting for anyone following the process is how much, sadly, it kind of mirrors what happens with the Olympic bidding process. And not that there's always as much in the way of mass casualties, but I know that in Brazil, as far as the work on some of the facilities, there were a few people working on the stadiums and whatnot that didn't make it. So this is one of these things where I know there's been a lot of speculation in the media over the last couple of years about the narrowing down, and it seems like there have been less bids for the Olympics and for the World Cup the last couple of times. As we get to a point where there's the stricter scrutiny that there should be, are we going to get to a point in time where that's going to weed out a lot of countries that should be bidding on or that should not be bidding on this process, that would be doing it the wrong way, and that all this scrutiny might scare them off?
Well, you would hope, but, you know, as you suggest, we've got this counterweight to all of that, which is the fact that the Olympics have become so expensive, and they've become, in so many societies, associated with corruption and profligate spending and unnecessary spending and white elephants of stadiums and all that kind of stuff, that, you know, the countries that traditionally vied for the honor of playing host to the Olympics aren't interested anymore. You know, the last Olympic bidding process for the 2022 Winter Olympics, right, it came down to Kazakhstan and China for the Winter Olympics, Beijing. You know, all these other countries, I think it was Norway pulled out, and was it Sweden and Austria, you know, where you could argue that the values in terms of human rights conform to a greater extent with the values espoused in the Olympic Charter. You know, they don't want any part of this anymore, particularly after what they saw in Sochi in 2014, where you had to spend, you know, where they spent $50 billion or whatever, you know, and the IOC grandees go to these places and say, this is what we need, this is what we want, you've got to make this better than the last Olympics. Now, to be fair, London bucked some of that trend. You know, London did the games in a different kind of way than Beijing had done in 2008, and certainly a different way than Sochi would do in 2014. But, you know, we've gotten to this this tipping point, right, where we want the countries that whose values reflect those that are enumerated in the Olympic Charter. And at the same time, all these other circumstances are mitigating against that because those countries don't want to have anything to do with a movement that they consider corrupt. You know, do we have new leadership in Thomas Bach at the International Olympic Committee? Is there a whiff of reform in the air? Yeah, I think that's fair to say. You know, with Brazil, you know, it's certainly not all their fault. Nobody could have seen this coming in Brazil 7 years ago when they got the rights that the country would have so many disastrous situations engulfing it at the same time. So I don't think it's entirely fair to blame them for Brazil, but, you know, things have to change to make the Olympics what they were.
Absolutely, and as you point out, it's going to be very, very fascinating to see what the bidding process looks like in the future, just because more democratically oriented countries a lot of times are saying that they don't like the price tag. And that goes as far back as 1976, where it was Innsbruck instead of, I think it was supposed to be Denver initially.
That's right.
And the citizens at that point in time, how quaint that is, 40 years ago, whatever the price tag would have been then, probably a couple $1 million, they didn't like it. They balked at it, and it ended up not being there. So that's one of those conundrums, isn't it, that it's the dictatorships of the world that can pony up because the citizens don't have the right to say, we don't want to pay for that.
It is a problem, you know. And look, you know, 84, it was the same thing. You know, it was L.A. because nobody else wanted it. L.A. bailed out the International Olympic Movement. So, you know, this is not, as you said, something entirely new, but it is alarming. And, you know, when you have repressive authoritarian regimes where, you know, freedom of association, where freedom of speech and such things are not the norm, is that really where you want to be putting all of these games? Now, you know, the IOC one time would have argued, well, you know, we're opening up these societies, we're shining a light, you know, this is going to be part of a process that makes their societies more free and open. The problem is that just really hasn't happened. I guess you could argue with the exception of Seoul in 1988, which was already kind of heading that way. But you know, whatever positive effects the International Olympic Committee says bringing the game someplace is supposed to have on society, you know, we didn't see that in Beijing. We certainly haven't seen that in Sochi. You know, they went into the Crimea and into Kiev during the games themselves. So it just doesn't really hold water anymore.
Absolutely, yeah. That point was the precipitation of the tensions we've had ever since. Is, I don't know if you would say irony, or maybe that's not the correct word technically, but it's very interesting anyways that it all kind of started during that point in time. On a much brighter subject, back to that, recently with the Sporting Life, I know you were very happy with how this turned out with Engelbert Humperdinck subsequently following you on Twitter, but you picking his brain on what it was like to be a fan of Leicester, the story winning the English Premier League, for people in this country who still don't quite get the parallel, because, again, it's catching on a lot in recent years, but still not on par with the major American sports. In terms of parallels, you know, I was kind of scratching to try to think of something here, maybe like the 69 Mets, but when you look at the young pitching that they had, should they really have been such underdogs in the first place when you look at some of the Hall of Fame caliber arms that came out of that? So to be able to defy the odds to the extent that they did, the English Premier League, again, being something where money talks just like in this country. So if you can't afford the big budget, if you're trying to compete with the big boys out there and doing it in a much more grassroots kind of way, is there any kind of parallel you can give for what they did there? It can't be completely without precedent in sports, but it's one of these things that's hard to pin down, it seems like.
It is in the U.S. without precedent because we have an entirely different system, of course. You know, as everybody knows, we don't have promotion and relegation. So, you know, whatever the Mets might have been, you know, in 1965 and 1966 and 1967, they were a Major League Baseball team.
Yes.
They were, I guess at that time, what were there? Were there 24 teams in the major leagues at that time, something like that?
They were still better.
I'm fairly certain that even in 1966, 1967, when they still stunk, the Mets were better than any AAA team. Now, for a long time, of course, Leicester City was not even a second-tier team. You know, and has been a third-tier team fairly recently in English soccer. They almost got relegated out of the Premier League last year. So it is an incredible story. You know, we can't appreciate, you know, and people, you know, all over the world in their soccer leagues get a taste of this because, you know, in the cup system, you know, all the leagues are mashed together and they get to play each other division across division, you know, FA Cup, et cetera, although by the end of it, almost always, you know, it's teams from the top tier. We don't get, you know, a team from single A going up against the San Francisco Giants, you know, in a weeknight match to see who's going to miss. So it is impossible for us to appreciate. I mean, the equivalent would be, you know, a team of rank amateurs straight out of college beating the best hockey team in the world, I guess. You know, the Miracle on Ice, to me, is the same kind of thing. But they didn't just do it for one game, or two games, if you want to count the gold medal game against the Finns. They did it for an entire season in the most competitive, arguably, soccer league in the world. It's, you know, it's almost impossible to overstate the miraculous nature of what has been achieved there, and you know, a franchise that has historically been moribund or close to it. So, you know, it would be like taking that 1980 Olympic hockey team and putting them in the NHL in 1979-80 for that season, seeing them beat the Canadians with Guy Lafleur and, you know, and the Islanders with Mike Bossy and all those kinds of teams over the course of a season.
That's an excellent point. That would probably be the closest parallel, I would think, had that happened because of, as you say, the longevity of the accomplishment and everything that was involved there. And as we're scratching for historical parallels, and again, a little bit going back in the baseball world a few decades here talking Mets, there was another thing with Sporting Life recently that kind of caught my attention when you were talking with David Eisenhower about the love of baseball of both his grandfather and his father-in-law, Richard Nixon, and getting to kind of dab back into that a little bit. The time in this country when, again, that baseball was king, and it kind of seems a little bit foregone when you try to explain it to people today, but that period of time, did you get the sense from him, as far as that goes, from the experiences from his very famous family, that it was a matter of, again, baseball being king, and that was what kind of drew them into it, that it was unusual to be such a big fan of the NBA back in the 50s, say, or the NFL anything like that?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it was different. I mean, clearly, I mean, look, you know, Richard Nixon, of course, David Eisenhower's father-in-law, was a big NFL guy, was famous for sending plays to George Allen and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, and Dwight Eisenhower, his grandfather, played football, of course, at West Point, and Richard Nixon played football, or at least was on the team, as I recall it, Whittier in L.A. So, yeah, football was a big part of the lives of the 35th and the 38th presidents? No, 34th and the 37th presidents.
Right.
But baseball in American life occupies a unique place. And what's special about it to me, and I'm a big baseball history guy since I was a little kid, is the way that, you know, when I was 9 years old, I could sit down and talk to my grandfather's generation about the Zach Wheats and the Dazzy Vances of the world, the guys who played for the Dodgers when he was growing up, because we can understand their greatness through the numbers and through the stories and through the wins. That generational connection with baseball is to me what makes it so special. When Dwight Eisenhower is talking about the baseball players of his era, and what I think Eisenhower was born in 1890, you know, so he's a little bit younger than Cobb, and he's a little bit younger than Christy Mathewson, and I guess he's just 5 years older than Babe Ruth, you know. His baseball world, as opposed to the baseball world of a David Eisenhower, his grandson, who covered the Philadelphia Phillies for, I think it was the Philly Daily News. You know, there is a common language of baseball, which links sports fans and baseball fans, and that was what was nice about getting a chance to talk to him, and also, you know, just to hear, you know, about, everybody knows Nixon's affection for football, but to hear him talk about baseball, how into it he was, and he would make these teams and spend his time thinking about, you know, who was a better shortstop, Pye Trainer or Pee Wee Reese, you know, it was kind of funny. I'm sorry, Pye Trainer was a third baseman, of course. I meant Archie Vaughn.
Yes, and you're right. That's a side that we really didn't see of President Nixon, so it was very, very interesting for you to get to delve into that, and I'm with you on a lot of this stuff here, too, as somebody who grew up a big baseball fan and have enjoyed so many different aspects of it over the years. And as I mentioned last time you were on, I had a paper book copy of your father's Steinbrenner book when I was a kid and really enjoyed that. So there's just so many great aspects of, I guess, what you would call writ large baseball culture that are so very entertaining to all of us who are into the game. And speaking of your father, I wanted to mention this as well here, too. I know this meant a lot to you, the shout-out that he got at the recent Sports Emmys here from Aaron Cohen on winning the award that was named for him and getting to talk about that a little bit. So I wanted to just pick your brain on that a little bit, your thoughts. It must have just been, again, such a tremendous sense of pride getting to hear his remarks on that.
It was very nice of Aaron, who's a very talented writer and producer, to mention my father. And I think he's won the award now 10 times, which has got to be at least 3 times as often as my father. It's always nice when he talks about my dad and the work that he did. And he said, you know, it's been 15 years now since my father died. And he mentioned, you know, younger generation should check out his work. And it's true, 15 years is a long time. There are guys, you know, successful guys in the business now who don't remember him or the work that he did, younger people in the business. So that was nice. And it's nice that they have the award named for him, the Writing Award, which was, you know, what he prided himself on and which he excelled at. It's always nice to be there for that and to know, you know, that his work is still appreciated. And I think Aaron's right. It would be instructive to a lot of people to go back and look, because in TV, you know, we've lost a lot of the writing. There's some great TV writers out there, don't get me wrong, Aaron is great, and my colleagues Tom Rinaldi and Chris Connolly and Mark Schwartz, among others, you know, are great TV writers. But the way that it used to be, I mean, he was from a generation where, you know, that was one of the main parts of the job, and that's been lost, I think, a lot of it to some degree.
You know, on the one hand, I would be shocked to hear the notion that there are a lot of people around today that aren't really as familiar with the work of Dick Schaap. But on the other hand, again, I have been surprised too many times by what millennials don't know to really
right.
think that. So I'll take that at face value. That's kind of sad if that's the case, but it's good that there's people beating the drums to say, hey, go check out his work again. And
the other thing is, you know, if it's not mm-hmm. on the internet, you know, then people don't think it existed. You know, if all that stuff isn't on YouTube and you can't immediately Google it and find it, you know, like everything that's been done for the last 15 years, basically, then it's almost as if it doesn't exist.
True. But, you know, with Amazon and some of the other things out there, you should be able to find, you should be able to dig up things here. I actually just found a treasure recently. It was Paul Zimmerman's, I think it was The Thinking Man's Guide to Football, and I think it's out of print right now, but it just goes to show uh-huh. you can find really anything you
sure.
want to out there if you're determined enough to look for it. So,
yeah
there's got to be a lot of good Dick Schaap books floating around, even the ones that are classified as being out of print.
That's true. The books you can find, I was talking more about like the pieces from World News,
oh, yeah.
the 2020s and that kind of stuff. That's hard.
No, you're right about that. You're right. Although I also tend to wonder, you know, with YouTube, with Vimeo, some of the other ones out there, I mean, there's probably a lot of clips too, but you're right.
Yeah.
You're right. I mean, it's not,
yeah.
it's a thing where if you're not constantly feeding the beast, and he hasn't been able to do that, obviously, the last 15 years, that, yeah, you can kind of fall a little bit, you know, from the forefront. So, yeah, it's good that there's people that are out there like Aaron beating the drum on that and reminding people to go check it out. But with the ongoing work that is being done here, I certainly wanted to talk about this with you. Another of our two-time guests on the show, this piece that you guys did on the tremendous Ernie Johnson and really sort of showcasing the real humanity of this man, a great broadcaster, but as I have found personally, an even better man. And your piece really did justice to that. The one that you guys did at E60, and really deserved to win that award. That had to feel just like $1 million to win a piece like that, and something that was about as great a man as Ernie Johnson.
No, we in the business we talk about quite often the silliness of awards and this and that, but ultimately it's always better to be honored, and it's nice to be recognized. And that piece was special because it did touch a lot of people. And the producer, Dan Lindberg at E60, who worked on that, did a tremendous job. And none of it would have been possible without Ernie Johnson, who gave us, you know, so much of himself, and his wife Cheryl and their entire family, who were just tremendous to us. You know, it's like a funny thing. I mean, it sounds silly, but, you know, we spent so much time in people's homes and dealing with people. And, you know, when you set up, when you're doing a piece like this, you really are invading their space for a long time. And they were so gracious about it. Of course, you know, Ernie's a professional. He knows the business. He knows the way to do these things. So he understood. He got it, which was why I think for so long he was reluctant to do a piece about his family story, because he knew that it wouldn't be sitting down for 15 minutes and that's it. You know, that it would be days of this, of shooting and family and emotion. And sometimes you don't want to dredge up everything. But it was particularly rewarding you know, to win for that piece, and you know, it meant a lot to me. I know it meant a lot to our entire team at E60, where we've got so many talented people, great producers, great editors, great cameramen, and it's such a collaborative thing when you do a piece like that, which I'm not sure people understand. You know, the correspondent gets the lion's share of the credit because it's your face and it's your voice. But, it is in every sense more the producer and the behind-the-scenes people who are making those pieces as good as they can be.
It's a real team effort, no question about it, and something that you guys deserve to win collectively, as you said. And, In terms of the behind the scenes of this, something I want to ask you about, because I think this is probably a natural question to anybody that, you know, frankly saw that the piece was going to be done in the first place, and that being with Ernie working for an entity which is, to whatever degree, a big competitor of you guys, albeit there's a cooperative banner. You guys are each promoting each other's NBA games this time of year, but right. A competitor nonetheless. Was there any kind of red tape to go through on getting permission to do this, or did it just kind of flow easily as far as getting permission to pursue the story?
As far as I know, nobody asked for any kind of permission, and I think if they had, it would have been great. I mean, it was a great story, you know, as I think anybody who saw it would acknowledge. And I think you know, we're lucky at ESPN in some ways to be in a position where, you know, we could do stories about, if you want to call them rivals or other people in the industry or this or that. You know, it is the competition, but as you suggest, they're also our counterparts, you know, where we respect each other's work. We respect each other's commitment to putting the best product possible on the air. You know, certainly those guys have, you know, they don't need me to say it, have done an incredible job on that NBA show for so long. So, you know, if there's a good media piece out there about, you know, somebody who happens to be at another network or, you know, at another magazine or another radio network, we're eager to do it. You know, I'm going out to interview. Not that he's working for a rival, but media stories, if we shy away from them, it tends to be because we don't think that the general public is interested in media stories or members of the media unless they happen to be former athletes or something like that. You know, Ernie Johnson is an exception. I think a lot of people feel like he's in their house. But as before I cut myself off, like I'm going out to do a Vin Scully story this year. Now, obviously, you know he's doing the home games for the Dodgers. It's not a competition the way you could say TNT is or something like that. But
sure,
it's a great story, you know, whether or not he's a guy in the media.
Oh, it is, absolutely, and it was a big thrill. I got to see recently, that was one of the rotating games they were doing on the Yahoo Game of the Day, so it was just amazing to be able to kick back and watch a Vin Scully game, which I don't generally get in my part of the country here, Cleveland, Ohio. So it's nice to be able to see that on the occasion that it happens, and we can only really look forward to what that story is going to be, and you actually perfectly anticipated it. I wanted to bring this to anything that's coming up subsequently, E60, Scoring Life, any of the stories that you're working on that we're going to be seeing in the time ahead here.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to promote it. There's some great stuff. I mean, I think it's great stuff that I'm working on for E60. You know, there will be this Scully piece coming up when we're back in the fall. I'm working on a one-hour special about the effect of the heroin epidemic on sports, through the lens of sports, heroin and opioid epidemic. I'm working on a profile of P.K. Subban, who's just like one of the most magnetic personalities I've been around in sports. What else have I got that I've been shooting lately? I think I'm doing a piece. I'll be shooting a piece soon with the quarterback Derek Carr, who's got an interesting story. So, you know, there's always something. There's always something that's getting shot, you know, and sometimes, you know, if a team doesn't make the playoffs or something, it gets pushed back, you know, and, you know, for the next season. But, you know, the way we do these things, there's always a lot in the hopper.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, those all sound like they're going to be very interesting and informative. But one in particular that I want to draw you out on a little bit, because my home state of Ohio has been particularly hit hard, as have a lot of others, I guess, by this opioid epidemic. And as far as people turning to heroin and some of these things here, if you're going to be focusing on something from a sports perspective, are you finding a lot of, in the preliminary research thus far, are you finding a lot of the same things with society writ large, where I know in our state they very successfully shut down a lot of the pill mills several years ago, and I think that's what's happened in some of the other states that have been hardest hit, and people that were getting addicted to prescription medication are now turning to heroin. Are you finding that in the sports world in your preliminary research for this story?
Oh, yes. Yeah, entirely. You know, and a lot of it is, you know, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to quantify, you know, how many people who are now heroin addicts, you know, became heroin addicts through exposure to prescription opioids. But it's certainly the vast majority. It's harder to figure out how many of those people were using prescription opioids for a legitimate medical reason as opposed to, you know, just looking for a way to get high. In sports, you know, there are a lot of stories of people suffering some kind of sports injury. You know, the doctor gives them some kind of painkiller, which they might need. Maybe they're given the correct dosage. Maybe they're given too many pills. You know, you know, that's one of the problems these days. You know, you get a wisdom tooth extracted, and they give you a 30-day supply of Vicodin or something like that when you need a 4-day supply. What happens to all those other pills? You know, they're ending up in the hands of people who shouldn't be taking them, and they get hooked. And not everybody gets hooked, but some people get hooked. So how many people, you know, are through sports injuries, or how many people are just doing it because of peer pressure, because, you know, somebody on the hockey team got a prescription for a legitimate injury, and now he's sharing his pills, or she's sharing her pills. But that's where it's coming from. It's all the experts that I've talked to so far saying, you know, nobody just becomes a heroin addict pretty much without having been on some other kind of opioid before that.
That makes a lot of sense. And again, especially for as much as law enforcement in recent years really kind of tightened up on a lot of these pain management centers or whatever they were calling themselves. But yeah, I know personally a good friend who has said that he's known 5 people that have died in the last year from heroin overdoses. So it really is something that's getting to be pretty bad. Yeah, it's truly. And then another friend of mine, it was one of his best friends just died recently, and I believe that's what the cause was. And yeah, it's a thing where again, and what's been very illuminating about that is being an election year, it does seem like it's finally getting a little bit more coverage, and it does seem like it's sort of getting forced to the forefront a little bit more. That because in the past this issue has really been kind of marginalized. So your story is going to take on an even more interesting tint in light of some of the legislation that's going through in various places, not least of which nationally.
Yeah, it seems every day now. I mean, I would say a year ago, it felt like nobody was talking about it, and now everybody's talking about it. And, you know, it seems like I pick up the Times every day, and there's a story about legislation being proposed or something terrible going on, or people who are upset about sober houses in their neighborhoods. But, you know, the story is penetrating at all levels of society now.
It really is, and I look forward to checking out your treatment on it from a sports-oriented perspective and the other things that are going to be in the hopper here. Always a pleasure to have you on, Jeremy. You're a great conversationalist. We really value that on this show. Congratulations again on your ongoing great work. Look forward to catching up with you in the future. Thank you so much for taking time for us.
I can't thank you enough. Thank you for so many terrific questions, and hope to do it again soon.
Wonderful. We'd love that. The pleasure's all mine, sir. Thank you. Have a good one, and thank you, everybody, for tuning in to FDH Lounge mini episode number 726.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.